Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You will find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Belva Davis, broadcast journalist, host of KQED Television's This Week in Northern California, and your chair for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Jody Cantor, art and leisure editor of the New York Times, and author of the new book, The Obamas. Jody Cantor's rise in her profession mirrors the amazing rise in the life of the couple that she's written so intimately about in her book, The Obamas. She graduated magna cum laude from Columbia University in 1996, enrolled in law school at Harvard, but dropped out after one semester because she felt such a strong calling to journalism. By the time she was 27, she was making history at the New York Times, where she became the youngest person ever to become editor of a section of the newspaper, the Arts and Leisure section. By 2007, she was covering politics for the Times, including the presidential campaign of 2008. She wrote some of the earliest articles about Barack and Michelle Obama and their daughters. By November of 2009, she landed a handsome contract to write a book about the first family and took a leave of absence from the Times. Her book was published in January of this year. She is married to a fellow journalist, and they have a daughter. Needless to say, The Obama is a bestseller, and we are fortunate to have Jody Cantor as our guest here at the Commonwealth Club today. Please, a warm welcome for Jody Cantor.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to the Commonwealth Club for hosting me, to Belva, for that amazing introduction. This is such an incredible opportunity to meet you and to hear your story as well, and also to all of you for coming. I don't want to talk for too long because I'd rather us have a discussion about the Obamas, but I thought I would just start out by talking a little bit about presidential partnerships and the Obamas partnership in particular, and maybe telling you a few of the things you don't know or haven't thought about on that subject, which I hope will help you understand the Obamas better, but also to think about past administrations that you've watched as you look at presidents and first ladies in the future. I'm going to explain some of the issues that they face that are not necessarily apparent to the world. I wrote this book because I had been covering the Obamas for a couple of years for the New York Times when I started spending some time reporting in the White House. And what became really clear to me, this was in late 2009, was that these two people were undergoing a behind-the-scenes adjustment far more profound than we could see publicly, that becoming president and first lady was not something that happened in a flash on inauguration day when the president said the oath of office. It was a slow and sometimes painful process that was happening mostly behind closed doors. And so the book at the end of the day is really a series of stories that weren't known before about what Barack and Michelle Obama really faced in the White House, what those jobs are really like, the enormous challenges they faced, what it was like to come from the universe of normal citizens, because part of what is special about the Obamas is that just a few years ago they really were a normal Chicago couple, and what is it like to come from there to the White House? And try to adapt to that world and adapt to those roles. And so one of the things I really watched in my reporting is I watched the Obamas change. Being president and first lady is by definition a transformative experience, and I was constantly asking, what is the effect of being in power on these people. They were always the outsiders, right? They were always the ones who said, if we could run the system would be fairer and better. How did they change while assuming their roles? What were their successes? What were their failures? What compromises did they make? One huge change that I saw and that I chronicled is the change in their own partnership. And so I wanted to talk about some of the ways in which presidential marriages are not like the rest of our marriages. Most of our marriages are pretty private affairs, right? We decide who to get married to. We have a clear delineation between our work and our home life, what goes on between, my husband and me or your spouses and yourselves. It's private. It doesn't really affect your work life. It doesn't necessarily affect other people. Presidential partnerships are different. If you look at Edith and Woodrow Wilson or the Clintons or Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt, we see that the dynamic between the two people in these roles can really affect the entire country, can really affect all of us if we don't know it in real time. And these marriages are not as private as the rest of our marriages. They, in some sense, belong to the whole country. And so here are three of the things that I think make them really, really different and that are worth paying attention to, and we'll talk about the specific case of the Obamas, but also you think about the other presidents and first ladies you've observed as well. So the first issue I want to raise is that of equality. There's a story in the book that Laura Bush's chief of staff told me about Laura Bush giving Michelle Obama a tour of the White House after the 2008 election. It was Michelle Obama's first time really checking out the place where she was going to live. Laura Bush takes her upstairs to the private residence and to a small sitting room, and there's this inconspicuous little window that overlooks the Oval Office and the Rose Garden. And Laura Bush said to Michelle Obama, "My mother-in-law, Barbara Bush, showed this window to Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton showed it to me, and I'm showing it to you, and you will show it to your successor when it's time for you to leave." And she talked about how she would stand at the window, but just to the side so that nobody could see her from the outside. And she would look out on what was going on in the presidency, at what her husband was doing in the Oval Office, on what was going on in the Rose Garden. And it struck me as the perfect metaphor for first ladyhood, because these women have such proximity to power. They have such an intimate relationship with what's going on in the presidency, and yet they remain a little bit hidden, and we don't really see their influence. And that's in part because our nation still doesn't treat the president and first lady as equals. You know, it's almost like we can't decide whether first ladyhood is really a job or not. You know, does it come with a lot of obligations? Absolutely. Does it pay anything? No. And the first lady can't hold a job in the outside world, right? I mean, that's been the line that's never been crossed by any first lady. And so, you know, every first lady has to answer the question, sort of, what am I here for? You know, what's my role beyond doing the Easter egg role, in early spring? What am I going to do with my time here? It was a very hard question for Michelle Obama to answer, because when she got to the White House, she was really a stranger in a strange world. She had been a hospital executive in Chicago about 5 minutes before. After her husband won the 2008 presidential election, she actually contemplated staying in Chicago for longer, finishing out the school year with her girls while her husband moved to the White House. First, the plan didn't last, but I think it teaches us a lot about Michelle Obama. First of all, here's somebody who was new to the presidency, right? You know, who didn't quite realize yet that the nation would probably not have loved the idea of a commuter first lady, especially if you remember back in those heady days, people were so excited to see this particular family move into the White House. But on the other hand, we also see that, you know, Michelle Obama is the worrier in that partnership. She's often the person who anticipates problems first. And I think that there was a kind of outsider spidey sense she had, because the truth is that living in the White House with two young girls is not an easy feat. It's a really hard way to live. We'll talk about this more, but I would really, you know, I always urge people, dispense with your glamorized images of state dinners and Air Force One. This is not an easy existence. Very few of us would choose it, if given the choice. So Michelle Obama gets to the White House, and, you know, remember that all of the action is in the West Wing, the president's domain, and it's not clear what her role is in the presidential message. It's not clear what she's supposed to do every day, sort of what her activities as First Lady are going to be. And it's sort of this system that doesn't treat the First Lady as anything close to equal to the president. I'll give you a small but telling example, which is that the president has, because the president is the commander-in-chief of the military, he has these military aides who attend to him, including two valets who take care. Now, I usually ask this question, does anybody here know what a valet is? Like not the parking kind? If you watch Downton Abbey, you may know it's the guy who takes care of a really important person's clothing. And so the president has these two valets who, like, attend to his every need clothing-wise. Like, White House aides laugh because they say the president's closet, if you go up to their bedroom, is arrayed with surgical military precision. Every sweater is perfectly folded, and every pair of pants is the same distance as every other pair of pants. And yet, you know, the First Lady doesn't get that kind of service. So think about what it would be like in your own home if you and your husband experienced a different level of service on a daily basis. And that's just a microcosm of the way the whole system works. When I interviewed the Obamas in 2009, I asked them, how do you have an equal marriage when one partner is president? And the First Lady laughed, like it was kind of a laugh of recognition, like she was glad that somebody had asked. And then she did a very smart thing, which is that she sat back and let her husband answer the question. She kind of refused to help him out. And he really stumbled through the reply. The president, you know, the president doesn't often, you know, fudge an answer, but he took four tries to get through the answer, and he finally said, well, my staff actually cares more what my wife thinks than what I think, which was actually a clue for me because I was beginning to get the impression that Michelle Obama is, in a sense, the kind of keeper of standards in the White House. But so, you know, that issue of equality is really, really hard for a contemporary couple to face. And so part of the story I tell in the book is really of Michelle Obama finding her way. Her story in the White House is a very triumphant one because that original start was so confusing. And, you know, the White House was just such an alien place for her. And she really managed. It's funny. She's often kind of more frank when she's interviewed by kids than she is when she's interviewed by professional journalists. And a kid a few months ago, I think in England, asked her what her greatest life accomplishment is, and she said, I've been able to thrive in situations that are not natural to me. And I knew because of my reporting exactly what she was talking about, which is the White House is not at all her natural environment, and yet she had managed to really succeed in a major way there. So the second issue that I want to mention that we should always keep in mind when we talk about presidential partnerships is the extreme isolation of the White House and its effect on a partnership. It is hard to imagine. It was hard for me to find the words in writing this book to convey how isolating the White House is. I would talk to old Obama friends from Chicago all the time, and they would say, I don't even know how to get in touch with the Obamas. Michelle used to be my boss, you know, or, you know, the president, you know, was a mentor of mine 10 years ago, or we used to be neighbors and we were pretty good friends, but, you know, can I call? Who do I email? I don't want to bother them. You know, I just want to pass along encouragement. You know, do they want to talk to people? You know, they kind of used to know, et cetera, et cetera. But Barack Obama revolutionized online campaigning in 2008. And yet, when he got to the White House, they took away his BlackBerry because they don't want to see the President of the United States' emails hacked. You know, everything in the White House has a rule, and there's always a good reason behind it. These rules are not arbitrary, and yet when you add them up, they become kind of absurd because, you know, the rest of us can use BlackBerries however we want. Our 17-year-olds have iPhones, and yet the President of the United States, who holds the nation's nuclear codes, doesn't have the ability to email with whoever he wants. And so that's another way in which the isolation sets in. The isolation is also very physical. I I'm going to borrow your book for a second. I actually included maps of the White House and of the grounds with little annotations because I wanted to show you something that you will not see on a White House tour that they won't talk about, which is that the first family is so restricted in their physical movements. They can never do anything spontaneous because the Secret Service always has to scope it out beforehand. You know, if they're in a city, like if they come to San Francisco for the day and you watch the motorcade, you'll notice that it never stops because they never want the president and first lady standing still because then you become, you know, more of a target. People figure out who you, where you are. Part of what's interesting about the first family is that they really all have a different level of security. The president is a virtual prisoner. Michelle Obama has a bit more mobility. The girls are quite free to move around Washington, although they do have Secret Service agents. Imagine what it would do to your family if each of you had a different level of freedom to move about in the world, how it would change the family dynamic. And another part of the isolation is that, you know, lots of people don't treat you normally. I tell a little story about Brad Pitt in the book, and you say, like, okay, what's the Brad Pitt story doing in a supposedly serious work of political journalism? But it's there for a reason, which is that he met with the president in the spring of 2009. He was pushing this initiative to build low-cost, environmentally friendly housing in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. So he got his Oval Office meeting, and as White House aides tell the story, he acted really strange in the meeting. This extremely charming, magnetic, confident movie star barely said a thing in the meeting. I called his office afterwards, and you know, they admitted that he was basically overwhelmed by meeting the president and being in the Oval Office. And so the moral of that story is that, you know, not even Brad Pitt acts normally around you, which is another form of isolation, really. And so all of this helps explain why these presidential partnerships, why these first marriages are so incredibly intense, because your spouse is basically, you know, amid all of this isolation, your spouse is your partner, you know, the only person you can trust to talk about so many things, the only person who treats you normally in this really strange environment. And we see this again and again. You know, the same thing really happened to the Obamas as happened to many, many first couples, which is that you know, the historical pattern is that first couples grow closer in the White House because the intensity of the partnership is so great, the degree to which you really need to rely on each other. It's sort of the two of you against the rest of the world. The third thing that I want to mention about first marriages is the kind of political marketing of them. Now, if we're being really honest here, I think we have to admit that most of us do market our marriage in some ways, right? When you have, you know, a lovely picture on your desk at work of you and your spouse on your honeymoon, part of what you're doing is projecting a very positive image, right? And saying, like, look, I have this nice life, we're married, we went on our honeymoon, et cetera, et cetera. Presidential couples market their partnerships on a far more profound level. George Bush, the first George Bush, became famous in the 1992 presidential campaign, which was a very closely fought race that he ultimately lost, for introducing every policy initiative of his by saying, Barbara and I really feel that da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that was because his wife was so much more popular than he was, that he was constantly, constantly invoking her. And you know, the same thing has happened to the Obamas. They have become much, much more of a public partnership than they were at the start of the presidency. If you look at the beginning of the presidency, you really have Barack Obama out there much more alone. And part of what happened during the administration, of course, is that his popularity dropped. But Michelle Obama's stayed very, very high. And so the White House began to incorporate her into more and more events. Now, on the one hand, they were careful because they never, as you watch the 2012 campaign unfold, You'll almost never see Michelle Obama talking about anything controversial because they don't want to taint her with anything hard. They want to keep her ratings really high. Like, she wanted to be much more involved in the selling of the healthcare overhaul initiative in the summer of 2009 than she eventually was. And that was because they felt that, frankly, the president was already dragging down his approval ratings because healthcare had become so controversial. And the last thing they wanted to do was take Michelle Obama's image, which had become this kind of golden perfect thing, and, you know, and weigh that down with all the baggage of healthcare reform. But they did, over the course of the administration, start turning to her more and more, start incorporating her more and more. When I interviewed the Obamas in 2009, I asked them a very blunt question. I said, are you concerned ever that you're marketing your marriage for political gain? We see, you know, all these beautiful pictures of you, et cetera, et cetera. They really pushed back on the question. You know, they said, they acted like they were almost kind of passive participants in the whole process. They said, oh, you know, people take these pictures of us and they end up out there. And, you know, this is, we never sort of intentionally market our marriage. But lo and behold, a year later, there was a meeting in the Oval Office right before midterms. Michelle Obama had been very reluctant to campaign for midterms. She had withheld her agreement for about a year for a couple of reasons, one of which is that she wanted to see the White House political team really organized, really strategic. These were the people who had contributed to the loss of Scott Brown's seat in Massachusetts. She didn't feel they fully had their act together. She didn't want to participate in what they were doing until she felt they really had a strategic plan. She did, much like Hillary Clinton in the Clinton White House, she didn't like being used as a political prop. You know, go here, introduce this person, you know, go to that event, go to that ribbon cutting. I mean, this is a strong, independent, professional woman who did not want to be moved around like a piece on a chessboard. So they finally had this meeting in the Oval Office for both the President and First Lady to convince Michelle Obama to campaign for midterms. And so the Obamas sat there, and the White House political team came up to them one by one and presented them with all this information about the political potency of the Obama marriage. And the polling and the stats that they showed basically said, look, do Democrats like seeing the president alone? Sure. But what Democrats really love is seeing the Obamas together. And so a couple, and Michelle Obama was very persuaded by the data that they had. So a couple of, really just a couple of weeks later, I was in Pennsylvania covering the midterms, and I noticed all these posters around town that said things like, vote for Joe Sestak, who was a local candidate, and yet the picture on them was not a picture of Joe Sestak. It was a picture of the Obamas with their arms linked, arm in arm, you know, looking at each other, looking at the crowd, et cetera, et cetera. And the White House knows the potency of that image. You know, it's what people really love it. It's what we saw on inauguration night, right, with the two of them dancing together. It was the rare kind of magical image in American politics. And we will see the White House deploying that again and again and again before re-election. They definitely stage a lot of stuff to emphasize the warmth and strength of the Obama relationship. I even remember a moment last summer when the president was coming home from a domestic trip, and when Marine One lands on the White House lawn, it's kind of a moment. There are photographs. People watch the arrival and whatnot. And they had Michelle Obama come out to greet him. And he had, like, bought her a pair of garden shears, on the trip. And it was, you know, on the one hand, it was kind of staged because he was doing a presidential trip. He wasn't, like, wandering through, you know, hardware stores spontaneously. And also, I don't know that Michelle Obama is actually the one getting down on her knees on a daily basis in the White House garden, you know, working with the shears. But that's part of the image that the Obama White House wants to project, right, of this couple who have this very real, very positive relationship. And so that is something I urge you to keep a lookout for as the campaign unfolds. You know, look at the imagery, look at the speeches, and see what the Obama White House is trying to say about this bond, and judge for yourself whether you think it works. So thank you so much. I'm very eager to take your questions. Ask me about anything about the president, the first lady, the 2012 campaign, the White House.
Thank you very much. We have questions here already for you. The First Lady is portrayed in your book as a woman who is not fond of politics. Despite that, do you think there's a potential political future for Michelle Obama?
I am on the record many times as saying that if Michelle Obama ever runs for public office, I will physically eat every page of my book. Because to say that she's not fond of politics completely understates it. She really never wanted to be a part of this world. When her husband ran for state senate, you know, she couldn't figure out why. You know, remember that Springfield in Illinois, it has a worse reputation than Sacramento. I mean, it's a notoriously corrupt state capital. And for her, it was like, my husband, the president of the Harvard Law Review, is going to go work in this sort of sleazy place. And she sometimes represents her antipathy towards politics as kind of a mom issue, you know, as saying this has required enormous sacrifice from our family, the years of absence when Barack Obama wasn't home for dinner at night. But there's another issue, too, which is that she has a really powerful critique of the political system, right, of the patronage, of the corruption. I think people don't necessarily realize how deeply square and upright Michelle Obama is and how righteous she is in a lot of ways. And the kind of compromises that you have to make in the political system are not easy for her to tolerate at all. What I think is sort of the dramatic twist of the story is that she learned to, and that for her husband's sake, she became kind of a master of politics in her own way. But would she ever actually go out there and run for elected office herself? I really don't think so.
A series of questions on this, Carrie. What are the president's work hours, 7 days a week or what? And who feeds the dog?
There's an interesting fact that I reported about the president's work hours that audiences tend to have two different responses to. One of the things I found out when I was writing this book is that Obama has a rule that he will not miss dinner with his family more than two nights a week, which is a very unusual rule for a president because, you know, presidents are often jetting around the country, schmoozing in Washington at night, et cetera, et cetera. And this has definitely contributed to this is a pretty introverted president, right? I mean, the president and first lady have never had the Clintons over to dinner in the White House. When they're done working, they are really, really done working. They've established very clear boundaries between their sort of jobs and the rest of their life, which is very hard to do in the White House. And, you know, I've gotten two different audience responses from the 6:30 dinner rule. Some readers have said, I think it's totally great that his commitment to his family is real. It's not just advertising. And if that's what he needs to do to stay grounded in the presidency, that's what he should do, no question. You know, other readers have said, wait a second, I have a job that's not nearly as demanding or important as his, and I'm constantly missing dinner with my family, and I want my president to be available all the time. So I don't really have, you know, an opinion on any of this, but I just like hearing the kind of reader reactions because there are, you know, it's an incredibly hard role to fill, and I think there are all different ways to do it, and every president and first lady have to find the sort of boundaries along what they're willing and not willing to do. As to the second question about who feeds the dog, I don't know that I could give you a very firm answer other than to say that there's kind of this groundskeeper guy at the White House who often takes responsibility for Beau. But what I can tell you is that Beau is by far the most accessible member of the Obama family. He runs around the White House constantly, like mingles with everybody, tour groups, visitors, whatever. I've often, you know, run into Beau while waiting for a meeting. And you know, it's funny because he really is a great ambassador because you can run your hands all over Beau, and he doesn't mind, right? I mean, he's a dog. And so it's, you know, like I remember the first time people, I was in this waiting room, and people were like, oh, you got to scratch Beau. And I was like, it's the president's dog. I'm not going to, like, you know, like I'm not going to, like, is that serious reportorial behavior? And everyone was like, oh, come on, it's Beau. And so anyway, he's a very, very friendly White House ambassador.
Another question. If you could do it all over again, would you have spent more time with the president himself?
Oh, absolutely. We never stopped trying to get interviews with the president and first lady. In my case, I was very lucky to get the time that I did get with them in 2009. You know, I think this is something really important to keep in mind as you're watching the news and as you read political biographies. We are in an age of non-access to leaders. My colleagues and I at the New York Times get interviews so rarely with presidents, with first ladies, with candidates. Obama, when he was running for president, sat down once with reporters from the New York Times, and we're the New York Times. During the presidency, the White House correspondents, my colleagues who cover the president day to day, have also gotten one interview with the president. And that's part of why I was so lucky to get the president and first lady together when I did. So we never stopped requesting those interviews, and I did many times for the book. But, you know, I would be really surprised if you see Michelle Obama give one serious news interview during this presidential campaign. Yeah, and I mean, you know, sort of sit down with 60 Minutes, or Gwen Ifill, you know, another really substantive show of its kind. Most of the interviews she gives are, you know, talking to Better Homes and Gardens magazine for 20 minutes about a school lunch initiative, et cetera, et cetera. The access is just incredibly restrictive.
Reminder now that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our guest today is New York Times Art and Leisure editor Jody Cantor, who is discussing her new very high-profile book, A Look at the Obamas. It is called The Obamas. Question for me. Are you or have you been surprised at the amount of racism that this family has faced since being elected?
Well, you know, I think there's something about it that's surprising and something about it that's not surprising. One is that, you know, there's not that much that's completely overt, right? It's pretty rare that in the mainstream media or in mainstream news events you see something really racist happening. It happens from time to time. What I think is more surprising is the extent to which there's this kind of veiled antipathy towards the Obamas that seems like racism may be crossed with some xenophobia due to the president's, you know, very international upbringing. And that's something we see, you know, Obama aides call it the dog whistle, because what they mean is that it's sort of like a signal that people often on the right will send to other people that can only almost be heard if you're tuning in. So as an example, they give, you know, the Tea Party rhetoric saying we need to take back our country from Obama. And, you know, the attitude of Obama aides is like, you know, oh, you know, take back our country. What are they really talking about? What's really going on, you know, with what they're saying? Or if you look at polling of Tea Party members, you know, a huge percentage of Tea Party members will say in polls that too much has been made of the problems facing black people in this country. So it's less like sort of outright name calling, but more this kind of resistance. Or if you look at the poll numbers, there's still a lot of states in the South where a really shocking number of people say that they think the president is a Muslim. And so, you know, Obama aides will say, well, you know, is there an element of racism in that? Is there, a sort of willingness to see Obama as other, you know, in some way, even if they don't want to engage in sort of classic racial name-calling?
Well, I'll tell you, as an African-American journalist, I must get an email a week from someone within that community talking about racism. but there is not a broader conversation because the president said we had that, I think.
Oh, you mean you'll get an email from somebody who's African American?
Did you see this? Did you hear that? What about this?
It's interesting because I do think African Americans are much more alert to it. I found that in talking to White House aides, African American aides sometimes had different perceptions of what was going on. Like, remember when Representative Joe Wilson cried out, "You lie," when the president was speaking to Congress? A lot of white aides in the Obama White House just interpreted it as rudeness and incivility. And a lot of African American aides that I talked to had a different interpretation. I mean, they felt like, frankly, that would not have been said to a white president, that it was a real respect issue. They even complained, it was interesting, when John Stewart interviewed the president, John Stewart called Obama dude. And one African-American aide who works in the White House said to me, "I have to tell you, you know, I really wondered about whether that was a little bit racist." And I was like, you know, I said, "Really, you know, John Stewart, like, you know, you know, really, are you willing to go there on that?" And he said, "You know, the problem with this stuff is that you never really know. You know, there's this kind of fear that it wouldn't be done to a white president, and you never really know." And by the way, I did hear afterwards that Stewart, I think, you know, he kind of regretted having doing that. But I think that it was also because, you know, Obama is of a different generation, right? He does seem like a younger, cooler, less stuffy guy than some of his predecessors. And so I can, you know, I don't think I would call him dude if I were interviewing him, but I can kind of understand John Stewart's impulse because Stewart is talking to somebody roughly of his own age.
Yes. Okay, change of subject. Under Bill Clinton, the Lincoln bedroom was constantly used by special guests. Do you think the Obamas use it frequently?
In fact, the opposite. The Obamas, very early on in the White House, decided that the Lincoln bedroom was kind of sacred space and that they weren't going to have guests stay overnight there. Now, Laura Bush had redone the Lincoln bedroom, and it is, like, it's not necessarily a bedroom you would want to sleep in now. It definitely looks like a museum. It would be sort of like crawling onto, like, a bed at the Smithsonian and going to sleep for the night. But the Obamas decided that it was sort of off limits to regular guests, and I think that's for two reasons. One is that is the obvious history that we're talking about. But I think the other factor is that, remember that the Obamas have real concerns about the influence of money in politics, even as, you know, by the way, they have their own super PAC raising money for the presidential election. But the Lincoln bedroom during the Clinton era was really a symbol of the kind of, you know, selling of the presidency, right? The kind of use of this historic space for fundraising purposes. And they never, you know, wanted to look like that or be like that.
Right. Several critics have described your book as being full of gossipy tidbits. What is your response, and how do you feel that your book is, and how do you feel about your book? Is it based on factual evidence?
Oh, it's absolutely based.
I think I can answer it.
No, the book was very thoroughly reported. I interviewed over 200 people, including 33 current and former White House aides. And another thing is that I fact-checked the book, and I also hired a separate fact-checker. And I also hired my editor from the New York Times to work on the book. So everything was fact-checked before publication. And so even though the White House actually it's interesting, they had kind of a harsh initial reaction to the book before they had read it. Nobody has successfully challenged any of the facts in the book, save for, you know, there were one or two dates that I corrected for the next edition. You know, as far as the gossipy stuff, a couple of reviewers, even in positive reviews, did say that. And I definitely do not agree, because there's nothing in the book that's salacious or is there for sort of titillation reasons. Everything speaks to a serious theme in the presidency, and I'll give you an example. There's a story in the book about when Michelle Obama was invited to be on the cover of Vogue. The invitation came during the transition, and there was a real debate on her team about whether or not to do it. And it was an uncomfortable debate because her advisors, who are female, were divided along racial lines. The African American advisors wanted her to do it, and the white advisors were more reluctant, and they had two different distinct. Part of the reason I like telling the story is that the arguments on both sides are really so good. The African-American advisors felt very strongly that it was really important to see the first black first lady on the cover of Vogue, such a rare opportunity to battle negative stereotypes. So few women of color generally have been on the cover of Vogue. A real kind of symbolic moment. And they really wanted her to do it, and Michelle Obama wanted to do it. A few white advisors were much more reluctant because of the economic climate. Remember that this is sort of the maximum moment of, economic catastrophe in the U.S. And think of, the public anger back during that time over job losses and foreclosures and banker bonuses. And the white advisor said, this is going to be one of the first things you do as First Lady. Do you really want to be on the cover of what is a pure luxury magazine, that sells $10,000 dresses? The magazine alone costs like $5 on the newsstand, which is what plenty of people pay for lunch. And is this really, and by the way, Michelle Obama, you're a person of substance. Do you really want to be known as like America's first fashionista? And she went ahead and did it, and there was no backlash to it. So, it's funny because the few reviewers who talked about gossipy bits in the book never actually said what they were. But I had a feeling they were talking about stuff like that because, frankly, it's a little girlier than what you see in your average presidential book. You don't often see discussions of whether the First Lady will do the cover of Vogue, in a serious work of presidential journalism. And yet, to me, it really speaks to some deep themes, right? I mean, what does it really mean to be a role model, right? It means that everything you do and every message you send is scrutinized. And in the course of sending one positive message, you may also be sending a message you don't want to send in the other direction. And how do you, do we want our presidents and first ladies to be aspirational figures who are dressed in fabulous clothing and look really terrific? Or do we want them to be, the much more kind of relatable model, dressed in stuff from Target and The Gap? And we kind of want both, right? And we're a little bit confused about what we want sometimes as a country. And also think about being a woman in the public spotlight and how all these women, from Michelle Obama to Sarah Palin, who are very quickly thrust into the spotlight, they want to look good because they're photographed 18 hours a day. But if you spend too much time and too much money looking good, you can be seen as materialistic or self-absorbed or get in trouble for having a Neiman Marcus shopping spree, as Sarah Palin did during the 2008 campaign. So I don't see that stuff as gossipy. I see it as pretty interesting.
What other First Lady would you compare Michelle Obama to, if there is a comparison?
It's funny because she gets asked that question a lot, and she really doesn't like it because she wants to be defined on her own terms. I think when you're First Lady, people are constantly making these analogies that you don't really buy into. Like, people would say, she's the new Jackie Kennedy because, her clothes are really fabulous. But if you look at Jackie Kennedy, she was a socialite. She went to finishing school, which is a little different from, Michelle Obama, daughter of the South Side and Harvard-trained lawyer. And if you look at Hillary Clinton, on the one hand, the comparisons are pretty deep because you have these two brilliant, determined, Ivy League-trained lawyers. And then on the other hand, Michelle Obama has a different set of desires and aspirations than Hillary Clinton ever did. And so, I don't know the extent to which she really identifies with one. It's funny though. Last May, I heard her speak at West Point, and she did something that was very surprising to me that I had never heard her do before, which is that in her speech, she talked about Martha Washington, and she actually read a letter that George Washington had written to Martha Washington during the Revolutionary War, and it was the first time. And this is, something like 3 years into the presidency, that I had ever seen Michelle Obama draw a line between herself back to the beginning of the Republic. And it was almost like she was saying, here's this line of women, right, back to Abigail Adams and Martha Washington, and I am a part of it. And that was, you know, early in the White House, you never saw her doing that kind of thing. And I did feel that it symbolized something about her acceptance of her role.
I did read the book. Yeah. And I think the most shocking passage for me was, I had never seen it before, maybe that's because I live west of the Mississippi, the actual words that transpired when Gibbs was was accused of, I think the word was, I don't know if it was cursing
he did. He said the F word in reference to the First Lady.
And I somehow that was just shocking to read, yeah, and to know that you had quotes around, yeah, those lines. Could you mind talking a little bit about trying to report that and trying to get it right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was, it was a really intense reporting process, because basically what happened is that there was a 7:30 staff meeting every day in Rahm Emanuel's White House, not with the president and first lady, but with all the top staff. And, you know, they would go over the events of the day and do some planning. And Robert Gibbs really blew up at one of those meetings because Valerie Jarrett, another top aide who's very close to Michelle Obama, had said that the first lady wasn't happy with his handling of something. And he lost it. And he ended up saying, you know, F her about the first lady, which, as you said, is a really shocking thing to say in reference to the first lady. And so, and also it wasn't an isolated thing. The two of them had a tense relationship for some pretty interesting reasons. So it was almost like the culmination of a very difficult couple of years between the two of them. So when I had first heard about it, and I slowly began to ask more people about it, you know, I was frankly worried about the whole thing, because I think that any time you're in a situation where you're going to reveal something really embarrassing, you know, that somebody did something that could have an impact on their future career and employability, you want to be incredibly careful. And so I made sure I knew what had happened. And then I went to Robert Gibbs, and it turns out he knew that I knew, and he was willing to talk about it on the record. He actually ended up blaming Valerie Jarrett for the whole thing. Yeah. The two of them have a really tense relationship. And so then the next thing I did is I made sure that I got, even though I basically knew what had happened, because I was writing the scene in the book, I needed to make sure that the actual dialogue was right. Because if I'm going to put something in quote marks, either in the Times or in this book, it really has to be the real words. Like, it can't be a sort of remembered half version. And so, fortunately, a lot of people had been in that meeting, and a lot of them were willing to talk to me about it. But it was painful, because they knew that Gibbs had made a really big mistake, and, you know, they all had different takes on the Gibbs-Valerie First Lady relationship. And then as I was reporting it, it became clear that the Obamas did not know what happened. And so I was in the somewhat weird position of knowing more about this meeting than they did. And they were both told what had happened before the publication of the book, because I had, you know, the White House really knew what material I had before publication, because I kept checking things to make sure that they were right. And so, you know, it's a really uncomfortable incident from start to finish. And I think what it also, I mean, first of all, it does show that the Obama team had grown fairly dysfunctional by the summer of 2010 when this happened. The very united Obama team that we remembered from the campaign had given way to, you know, the stress and recrimination of the White House. And since then, a lot of those people have left and the team has been rebuilt. But the other thing we see is how much pressure people in the White House are under. People in the White House often react in really outsized way to things. I mean, in a normal workplace, you know, if that kind of thing transpired, if one person said to another person, so-and-so is not happy what you did, you know, with what you did yesterday, you know, the person under the line of fire might just say, well, can you tell me more? Can you elaborate? I actually thought I did a really good job. And, you know, that's not what happened. Gibbs really exploded.
Following that, I wonder, did the administration have concerns as to how readers would interpret what had happened, and how did the president react when one of his top aides had said something so disrespectful about his wife?
Well, I think that they knew that I had this. They knew that I had reported it right. And so I do think they were concerned about it. And, you know, I think part of their initial pushback against my book, which actually ended when other journalists said, like, this is a not unflattering portrayal of the Obamas, but I think part of their initial pushback was that they didn't want this out there, right? I mean, there is a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff in this book that is painful or doesn't look great or speaks to kind of the growing pains of a new administration, and that's not the message they want to send.
Okay. Of course, you know the number one headline that came from some words that Michelle Obama recited on television about the angry woman. Do you think that you've been unfairly treated by that, or why do you think that Michelle Obama would make such a statement without having read the book?
Well, that's the mystery. She hadn't read the book, and you know, I wonder what her impression has been since, because immediately when she did that, all of these people from, you know, John Stewart to Glenn Lowry to Farai Chedaya to Bob Schieffer, you know, stood up and said in prominent ways, wait a second, the book doesn't portray her in that way at all. It's actually kind of a flattering portrait, you know, and really shows how resourceful and strong she was in sort of creating the role of First Lady for herself. So I do wonder if anybody has, you know, has gone to her since and said, actually, you know, the portrait of you in this book is very endearing in many ways. You know, to me, when I step back and I look at it as a reporter, part of what we see, and we see it in the reporting in the book as well, is that I don't think that this is somebody who is comfortable being a biographical subject yet. She's still very new to public life, and I think a really hard idea to get used to is that people are going to report on you and chronicle you, and biographies are going to be written, and you're going to be studied. And, you know, she's kind of passing into that realm where she's not only a real, live, thinking, feeling human being, but also a, you know, a sort of historical figure. You know, more than the angry black woman line, she also said something that was like, well, who can imagine, you know, what I feel, you know, or sort of write about me? And it was almost like she was pushing back against the project of journalism itself. I wanted to say back to her, well, in fact, I'm doing this the same way that many previous generations of journalists have done it. You know, you gave me access to your East Wing, and I interviewed your aides, and I checked all the information beforehand. And also, frankly, the point of a book like this is not to be the book that she will write. She will write her own book. But that memoir is very, very different than an independent assessment by a journalist.
Talk a little bit about your own association with members of the White House, those people who you needed, like her staff, to cooperate. Did you have a long-term relationship with them?
I did, because I had reported on the White House, on the Obamas, really, for years. I knew a lot of the people I'd be speaking to beforehand. I spoke to some new people as well. But I'd say that one thing that really helped me was having that long reporting track record, not only in terms of credibility, but also in terms of knowing the right questions to ask. You know, I'm sure you feel the same way as a journalist, but the whole trick is knowing the right questions. And for me, I think that one reason I was able to unearth a lot of new information is that I kind of knew what the issues were. I didn't know that Michelle Obama was having a hard time in the White House initially. I didn't know about a lot of what was happening behind the scenes when I started reporting the book, but I kind of knew where the fault lines were in this world.
I have interviewed Valerie Jarrett, an old friend, and yet she seems to be a real controversial person within the White House. Did you, at least reading the book,
yeah.
That was the impression I had. I'm not sure that her peers are so happy to have her around, let's put it that way.
She plays a really complicated role. Valerie Jarrett is one of the President and First Lady's best friends, long-term mentor, long-term advisor, and she's also a senior advisor in the West Wing. She's also the West Wing member who's closest to Michelle Obama. And, you know, part of what's interesting is that she's integrated into every part of the Obama's life. I mean, she works with the president in the West Wing, but she also goes on vacations with the Obamas. And so sometimes other White House staff members And also, by the way, she made, in a way, as big a leap as the Obamas did. She was a real estate executive in Chicago, very accomplished record in city government and civic involvement, but had never worked in national politics before the 2008 campaign. So she comes to the White House, and she's a real newcomer there in a very high-level role. And other staff members in the White House, and especially other politicos, sometimes regarded her with, you know, mistrust or suspicion. You know, what is the president and first lady's best friend doing in this meeting? Is she going to repeat, you know, everything she hears to them, et cetera, et cetera? That said, she's also forged some very close relationships with some of the Washingtonians and politicos in the White House. You know, everybody thinks that she will be the longest serving member of the top echelon of staff, that, you know, a lot of these other aides will come and go, but that Valerie will always be there because she's like family to the Obamas.
The president has made some adjustments within his team at the White House. Any comment on which way they're moving? He was at first, there were problems, people didn't feel that he had strong enough control over his staff.
Yeah, I think the White House has become a much, you know, in some sense, better run a place, kind of more corporate, more organized, more strategic. The other thing that's really happened is that they're fully in reelection mode. The line between, you know, traditionally there's supposed to be a line between government and campaigning. Boy, is that line fuzzy. So much of the White House, of what the White House does now is to promote reelection. And I think we see that also reflected in the power of people like David Plouffe. David Plouffe was the campaign manager in 2008, and now he's one of the president's top advisors in the White House.
In what way do you think your book will either help or hurt the Obamas as they go into this, or maybe they're already in the reelection mood?
You know, I really think about it helping readers much more than I do the Obamas, and here's why. Because I think that if you're an observer of this White House, if you're somebody who cares about politics, about Democratic politics, you know, there are different ways of learning about the Obamas, and you know, some of them are very limited. You know, on the one hand, you have these right-wing Republican attacks in which, you know, a lot of lies or vicious accusations are spread about the Obamas. And then you have the polar opposite, which is the White House PR operation. And the story that they will tell you is that everything is perfect and great in the Obama White House all the time. And, you know, my goal and the goal of, you know, too many colleagues to name like me, is to really give an alternative, to give a nuanced, information-rich look at what's going on in the White House that's independent, that's fair, that's deep, that's penetrating. And so, you know, in terms of helping, the people I'm out to help are really readers, you know, not the Obamas themselves. And part of me resists the way so much in political journalism is just turned into, you know, is this good for them or is this bad for them? Because a really complicated work of biography, you know, kind of doesn't belong in any of those categories, right? I mean, it can show you positives, it can show you negatives, it can raise new questions.
Time now for a few questions. If you would like to stand and go to the microphone and ask a question, please.
Thank you very much, both of you. Are we seeing the real Michelle Obama? Is her Jackie Kennedy-like coiffure, J. Crew, Millie wardrobe persona necessary for her to have credibility with middle America? And if so, isn't that sad? And if not, why not?
This is what I think you're getting in terms of Michelle Obama's public image. The Michelle Obama that we see in public is authentic. You know, when old Chicago friends look at her now, they say, I recognize her. This is not a different person. I recognize the maternal warmth. I recognize, you know, the commitment. I recognize the charm. But so that's authentic. But there's a lot that's been edited out. We're not getting the full Michelle Obama. The Chicago friends say, where is the force of her advocacy? You know, where is her brilliant critique of politics that she always had in, you know, Chicago? Where is the brainy Harvard-trained, you know, lawyer who can argue anybody into a corner? And so I think that a big part of who she is has just been taken off the table for public consumption. But part of what the book will show you is that that part very much exists in private. It hasn't gone anywhere.
Another question?
Yeah. After that Robert Gibbs incident, did you, and the publication of your book, did you hear from Robert Gibbs or anyone else who was in the room at that time?
Well, we had discussed it ad nauseum before publication. Like, I can't tell you how many hours were spent discussing that incident with Gibbs and other people who were in the room. So, you know, once they saw that it was right in the book, there wasn't that much to say. Gibbs, however, did give a statement after the book was published. He and Valerie Jarrett both did, in which, you know, they kind of tried to minimize and smooth over what had happened.
Another question? If not, how has the responsibilities in the East Wing evolved over time since the beginning of this?
Well, the main thing that's happened is that it's become much more substantive, because the way Michelle Obama figured out First Ladyhood was that she came up with two causes that she really wanted to devote herself to that felt substantive to her, that also, by the way, are real political assets. One is her childhood obesity initiative. The other is the work she's doing with military families. And once she had those projects going, her First Lady existence had some definition to it, right? I mean, she had things she was working on. She had causes she was devoting herself to. You know, I think the other thing that has changed is that she's very subtly trying to update the role of First Lady. You know, she is not going to be Hillary Clinton, who's ever going to take an office in the West Wing. But there are little things she's trying to do to kind of make the office more modern, a bit less formal. You know, even like with the state dinner, there was a state dinner last week for the British Prime Minister. There's this thing that First Ladies often have to do, which is that they have to, like, introduce the china and the menu the afternoon before the event. It is a really retro thing to have to do. It is very ladies who lunch. And what she did is she incorporated it into a mentoring event that she was doing for young women. And so she was kind of taking this really retro thing and yoking it to the greater cause, you know, a female empowerment. So I think there are a lot of subtle tweaks we're seeing from her like that.
How do you think the president's reputation is with women? I mean, the core of his administrative advisors, the top ones, I don't think there were any women at all.
Well, there's Valerie Jarrett, and obviously Hillary Clinton's the Secretary of State. But, well, the Obama White House, is trying to really make hay out of this now, because following the whole brouhaha over contraceptive coverage and, you know, that bill in Virginia that would have been very invasive in terms of women having ultrasounds, they're trying to cast Republicans as the enemies of women and to rally women to their side. So we'll see how successful they are. But he's always done better with female voters than with male ones, actually.
As a journalist, what, if anything, do you believe should be off limits to the public when reporting on the First Family?
Well, there are lots of things that I left off limits in the course of reporting my book. There were sometimes things that came up that were just too personal to the Obamas that I felt had no real relevance to the presidency or their story in the White House that I didn't include. And the biggest thing in that category is really anything with the kids that involves kind of the kids' personal lives. You know, there's a chapter on the Obamas as parents in the White House, but it's very much about the kind of public aspects of that role, about both protecting their kids from a media point of view and also about the role that the Obama girls play in the president's political rhetoric. What I wouldn't do, and what I think most journalists wouldn't do, is, you know, show up at Sidwell Friends, their school, and begin asking questions about what's going on. There was a little controversy yesterday because apparently Malia is on some sort of school trip in Mexico, and that briefly got some play in the media. And then everybody said, whoa, you know, reverse, and kind of realized that presidential kids, this is a private school trip. Michelle and Barack Obama are not even on it, and the consensus was that she should really be left alone.
The children, how do you think they have adjusted? Did you have any access to them?
No, because, like, you would never go up to Malia or Sasha and ask them a question. I did end up running into them in the White House a couple of times, which was interesting but kind of awkward because, you know, I'm a journalist, but I'm also a mom, and I didn't want to observe them, you know, and make them feel like, you know, animals in a zoo. And I really, once I was standing in the diplomatic room, which is the room that First Family comes and goes through. They don't have a private entrance or exit. And Sasha came in with her grandmother, and it was like 3 p.m, and she had a backpack, and she was pretty clearly coming from school. And the White House staff I was with both kind of nodded politely and said hello. And I found myself frozen, and I kind of turned away from her because I felt so uncomfortable and awkward that she had to run into a journalist in her own home. So, you know, the official line, which Obama aides and friends will tell you again and again, is that the girls are terrific, they're great, they've adjusted beautifully, they're grounded, they're down to earth, they're well behaved, et cetera, et cetera. There's no evidence to the contrary. You know, whatever private struggles they've and challenges they've faced as the president's kids, I'm just not sure we'll ever know about.
And it's a good time for me then to say thank you to you, Jody Kantor, arts and leisure editor of the New York Times and author of the new book, The Obamas. We also thank our audience here and on television, radio, and the Internet. I'm Belva Davis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you so much.